So my first question is, in the acknowledgments section of your new book, you say that this book, The Corporation, came together unlike any other book you published before. Can you talk about how this got started?
Well, first of all, it involves some people reaching out to me, and that's how it got started. That's never happened before. Most of my projects are self-generated, and there's a reason for that. That's the way I normally like it. I get into a subject because I'm really into it, and then I pursue that path. But this involved a couple young film producers in Miami that had been developing a project on the corporation, and they had come to the conclusion that they needed to try to do it first as a book, that it was a big, complicated story. And so because of Havana Nocturne, they were aware of that book. They contacted my agent and asked if I was aware of the story of the corporation and if I would be interested in writing a book on the subject. So, yeah, I was very aware of the story. I had been following Jose Miguel Battle and the story of the corporation for a decade or more, and kind of lusting from afar at that story because I knew it was a great subject matter for a book, but I didn't have the sources. And so I couldn't really figure out a way to get into that subject. So when these guys contacted me, yeah, I was very interested. My only question was, what did they have? What were they offering? And it turns out that what they had was David Shanks, who was the lead police officer, the lead cop, a Miami cop, and federal investigator who had been working the corporation, who had worked the corporation case for close to two decades, almost devoted his whole career to it, was very responsible for the corporation eventually being brought down in court. And so they had David Shanks, and everything David Shanks had accumulated over the many years of working the case. So he had everything in relation to the public record. He had police reports, police files, court transcripts, a motherload of information. So that was a start. You know, that wasn't the end all and be all, but that was a start. Because I like to try to write these stories as much as possible from the point of view of the criminal side, the people who live the events in the story. I don't do books solely about cops and in police investigations. A lot of people write books that way, and I choose not to. And so I knew that I needed to get a lot more information. I needed to find sources, either people who had been in the corporation, if they were still alive, and it turned out there weren't many who were still alive, or people who were one or two steps removed from this story who could help me tell it from the inside to the extent that I could, and get at the generation of Cuban Americans who got caught up in this drama of the corporation. And these guys were also helpful with that because they were born and raised in Miami, and particularly through their parents who were older and were part of this generation that I'm referred to. We were able to get some incredible interviews with some people I never thought I'd be able to get interviews with, and humanize the story, get at some of the personalities and characters who live this story, and give sort of an inside point of view from that side.
Yeah. You said you had been following it for a while, but for most people, Jose Miguel Battle is not a household name, and a lot of people don't know about, you know, that there was this whole Cuban American underground that lasted, you know, for 40 or 50 years. I saw you refer to the whole story as you called it the underbelly of the American dream. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been writing for years now about the process of becoming an American from the point of view of the criminal underworld, and particularly from different ethnic points of view. The many books on the Irish experience, Vietnamese gang, a lot of my journalism has been about criminal groups from Jamaica and Mexico, and just the process of coming to the United States and working through this this process of gangsterism that seems to be so central to the American process and has been, I think, from at least the late 19th century, formation of the Irish gangs, in the early 20th century with Prohibition. It used to be Irish, Italian, Jewish, and now it's newer waves of immigrant groups. And it really is sort of a process by which immigrant groups get their feet on the ground in the United States. Unfortunately, it initially usually involves exploitation of their own criminal organizations that take root within the community, and they're all geared towards making money and acquiring power. It intrinsically involves corruption of the political apparatus, corruption of law enforcement that makes it possible for this to develop. Now, when it comes to the Cuban experience, I found this really fascinating because it was a more recent story. It began in the wake of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s and the generation of Cubans that were displaced by the revolution. Castro took over and exiled a lot of Cuban Americans who weren't down with the nature of Castro's communist revolution. And so that became the impetus. It became the modus operandi of an entire generation of Cuban exiles, but also became the impetus for the formation of this criminal organization, because the criminal organization was linked to the politics. It was part and parcel of the element within the Cuban exiles that was dedicated to destabilizing Castro's government, killing Castro, assassinating Castro, and taking back Cuba. And so it was an underground political movement that was very active, that worked in consort with the CIA, starting with the Bad Pigs investigation and everything that followed over the next 3 or 4 decades. And so that was fascinating. That made the Cuban version of this American saga very unique and interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. You know, you've written about organized crime for a long time, and I was going to ask how the Cuban mob was different from the other ethnic groups, but do you think that the main part is the political connection?
Yeah, that's really what it was. This was a criminal organization that grew out of the consequences of the revolution. I mean, it was created by the revolution. The psychology behind it, led by Jose Miguel Battle, who had been a vice cop in Havana during the years of Batista, and had been a member of the Bay of Pigs Brigade, the invading brigade, and the invasion, of course, was a disaster, and he wound up in prison. And when he got out of prison, he first joined the U.S. Army, and then formed this criminal organization. And he never gave up the dream of killing Castro and taking back Cuba, although he got sidetracked into a lot of gangsterism and the numbers racket, which was the foundation of his criminal organization. He always saw himself as a freedom fighter, and a lot of people in the Cuban community saw him as a freedom fighter and revered him. He was a war hero. Mm-hmm. And so he was treated with great reverence. And there's no doubt that that aspect led to a degree of sympathy within the community, and also gave the corporation a kind of mystique in the larger United States, because it was believed they had some sort of connections to the CIA and that they were untouchable and that they couldn't be brought down. And that mystique although some of it was probably more legend than truth, but it had a certain power out on the street. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very unique aspect of the Cuban mob.
The game, numbers game, that's kind of at the middle of this whole story as well. Can you talk a little bit about that for people who might not know what Bolita is?
Yeah, the illegal lottery is basically what it is. I mean, before the lottery was legal, the lotteries, state lotteries, federal lotteries, only been legal in the last 20 years or so, 20, 25 years. So people don't realize that there was a time when the simple act of betting a number on a daily basis was illegal, and it was controlled by organized crime, and it was incredibly lucrative. You can go back to the 1930s in the Prohibition years and the wake of the Prohibition years. The second most profitable racket for organized crime after illegal booze was numbers, what law enforcement called policy, the numbers racket, what Latinos called bolita. And it's very simple. It's just betting on a three-digit number or a series of numbers on a daily basis. It's considered sort of a victimless crime. A lot of people do it. Little old ladies do it. Cops do it. The corner priest does it. It's a cultural tradition going way back. It was seen to be sort of harmless, but it was incredibly lucrative. It was considered to be a poor man's gambling because you could bet as little as a nickel. You could bet $10,000. So it was very popular in the ghettos, in barrios, among immigrants and poor people, because you could bet a little amount and hopefully you could maybe get a big return on your nickel or your dime or whatever. Mm-hmm. In the 30s, it was controlled by Dutch Schultz, who was a powerful gangster who was in control of the numbers racket in Harlem and other places and made lots of money on it. And there was always a Cuban element of the numbers racket because the mob, the Italian mafia, understood that Latinos were the dominant customers for this racket. And so it was wise to allow it to be run by Latinos. And so when Jose Miguel Battle came along in the 60s and wanted to create this organization, he touched base with the mafia and cleared it all with the mafia, made sure they got their piece of the pie and that everything was cleared with them, and began setting it up. And it's really pretty simple. You go bet a number somewhere in your neighborhood that you know of. It's usually at a bodega or an auto garage or some sort of shop or store. It can be anywhere. You go in and you bet the number. There's a series of ways you can bet. You can bet a series of numbers, or you can bet one number. People are very superstitious about the numbers that they bet. They'll make it the number of a saint's holiday or something like that. Everyone has their own formula for coming up with a number that they bet. And the winning number is based on the total mutual handle at the local racetrack that day. So the following morning, the racetrack betting totals are published in the local newspaper, and the last three digits of that number are the number for the day. Mm. And that's how it's determined. And like I said, it was immensely popular in the Latino community. Huge volumes of people bet. And so it could be really profitable. If you had a vast, sprawling operation like Battle did, you had a lot of money flowing through this criminal enterprise on a daily basis. I mean, they had rooms, apartments that were called counting rooms that were basically there just to store the money, to store and count the money. And so he created an empire based on this, a vast empire.
Yeah.
Eventually was in the billions of dollars.
Yeah, the day-to-day detail in the book about just how it worked day in, day out was really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, when you stop to think that Battle and most of the people that worked within his organization, you know, are not highly educated, formally educated people. You're talking about high school dropouts, And yet they formulated this pretty complex, multi-layered corporation. It really was a corporation. And ran it on a daily basis, and ran it in a way that was highly profitable for everybody. Of course, there was an element to it that the average capitalist enterprise doesn't have, and that's violence and intimidation. And Battle used that quite often to keep people in line and to make sure nobody was poaching on his territory, and for punishment and revenge and all these other psychological reasons that he had. So what wasn't supposed to be violent, Bolita's not supposed to be a violent racket. I mean, people who partake in betting the number don't want to feel like they're contributing to organized crime. So it's made to feel like kind of a mom-and-pop neighborhood thing where you go and bet the number. It's not supposed to be a criminal enterprise where people are getting killed because they've run afoul of the organization. Battle turned it into that. He was a true gangster and ran the operation like a gangster and created this fear, real fear and terror around around the corporation that eventually was what undermined that organization and brought it down.
Right. And he started that. I mean, he kind of laid that out early, that he wasn't to be messed with in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and I think some of that was a consequence of the Bay of Pigs. I mean, I call this generation of boliteros that created the corporation, I refer to it as the Bay of Pigs generation, because Battle and so many of his cohorts from prison formed this organization, and their network of friends and contacts were from this generation. And I think there was a certain amount of a process of shame and humiliation that that generation of immigrants had gone through. I mean, they'd been kicked out of Cuba in the most insulting way possible. And then they tried to get revenge through the Bay of Pigs invasion, and that was a disaster and a further humiliation. And so they had this strong sense of a need for revenge and not being made to look like a fool. And Battle had that and applied it to everything. He had many qualities that were attractive and positive qualities as a leader. He was charismatic. He was very earthy and soulful. People who admired him and liked him really were loyal to him and really admired him a lot. He had a big heart. He was known to take in stray dogs. That was one of the things he did on his property when he moved from New Jersey to Miami and had sort of a little farm in Miami, and he'd take in stray animals, particularly stray dogs. So he was a sentimentalist. He had a heart, but he had this ruthless side. I mean, if you crossed him, he would use violence as a first resort, not as a last resort.
Mm-hmm. When you started writing this, and up until, you know, the book is being published, what were the things that you discovered during your research that you found that you weren't expecting or that really surprised you?
Well, the thing that surprised me was the context of the Cuban exile anti-Castro movement's relationship with the CIA, and what a vast political underground that had been, and how that was sort of a narrative thread that ran through the entire 40, 50 years at the end of the 20th century, and it was kind of an underground thread. The CIA and various political administrations, presidential administrations, primarily Republican Party, would use the Cuban exile community to do all kinds of dirty political deeds, covert operations, throughout the latter part of the 20th century. So we have things like the Watergate burglary. I mean, the plumbers, the people who broke into the Watergate, were mostly Cubans who had been talked into doing that by a CIA agent named E. Howard Hunt, who had been one of the organizers of the Bay of Pigs invasion, and told them, you know, go do this burglary at the Watergate, and then we'll go get Fidel. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Cuban exiles were told time and time again. Go do this invasion. Go do this car bombing. go do this assassination of an ambassador from a country who's doing business with Cuba. Acts of terrorism authorized by the CIA, most of them done, most of these operations done secretly in Latin America and in the United States. Some of them quite outrageous and shocking. I mean, the ambassador from Chile in 1976 was murdered in a car bombing on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., in the middle of the afternoon. A Cuban jetliner airplane was blown out of the sky, flying from Panama to Havana with a bomb planted on the plane by Cuban exiles. So they were engaged in a war of terror against the Castro administration, and the CIA was aware of it and, in many cases, a partner to it, because in the mind of the CIA, this was the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And by destabilizing Cuba, they were destabilizing the Soviet Union. And so Cuba was a piece on the chessboard during the Cold War. So that was just fascinating to me, that there was this context in which the corporation existed. Battle was close to a lot of the key players in the anti-Castro movement. They had joined the army in the years after those guys got out of prison, and so Battle was friendly with them, and in some cases a financier of operations, including most notably the Contras, which were formed to take on the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. and in the Iran-Contra scandal, which was such a big scandal in the mid-80s in the United States. Cuban-American exiles were involved in that scandal. So that was a fascinating political context. I think, as I mentioned before, Battle had always saw himself as a part of that movement and had dreamed of being a more active participant in it. He got caught up on the gangster side of things, making money, revenge killings, the day-to-day running of his Bolita operation. But he did occasionally contribute money to various causes related to the anti-Castro movement. So he always had one toe in the water.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing research, whether it was for this book or other books that you've written, is it important for you to visit the actual places you're going to write about and see where the things happened, you know, to kind of walk the streets and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. It is for me. I don't know if all writers feel the need to do that. I feel the need to do that. Because part of what you're trying to do, I mean, I've done different kinds of books. I've done what you would call true crime books, that, you know, the Westies, Born to Kill, that deal with recent stories that have just happened recently, and I'll interview people who were participants in those stories and try to tell the stories through the eyes of those people. But I've also been doing historical works, you know, scholarly historical works like Patty Wacht and Havana Nocturne that involve eras of criminal activity that are long gone. Mm-hmm. And to me, the only way you can do those kind of books and bring them alive and not have them seem dusty and academic and far removed from the history you're writing about is to go to the locations and breathe in the actual physical place. And that was a requirement of this book. I went to Cuba, which I had done before for Havana Nocturne. I went to Madrid, Spain, where Battle hid out for a period in the 1970s when he had been indicted on gambling charges and went on the run, hid out in Madrid for a while, and intersected with many key figures who become prominent in the story in later years, met them there. And so I went to the very apartment building where he lived when he was there. I went to Lima, Peru, this wonderful part of the story in the third act where Battle is afraid he's going to get busted in the United States because his profile has become quite high. And so he runs away to Peru and starts a casino in Lima, first ever casino started in Peru, in Lima, Peru. So I went to Lima, Peru, and went to the building where that casino had been located, and sort of got a sense of the lay of the land there. Tons of trips to Miami. I'm based in New York. This whole story, the early parts of it take place in New York and Union City, New Jersey, where Battle lived. But eventually he moves down to Miami and runs the operation from down there. And so lots of trips to Miami to do interviews and find people who were still around who would talk to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very important. It's very important to travel and go to these places. I mean, I remember when I was writing Paddy Wax, which was dealing with history from, you know, some of it from the late 19th century. And I went to New Orleans, where a considerable amount of the history took place. Early Irish gangs formed in New Orleans, just as they had in New York. And in particular, there was a murder of the police chief of New Orleans, a guy named Hennessy, who was murdered by the mafia in the late 19th century. And it was a major event in the development of hostilities between the Irish and the Italian underworlds. And so I went to the very location where that guy was shot on the street in the French Quarter. And boy, you go to a place like that with knowledge of what happened there, and you can feel it. You feel it breathing in you. It's almost like you can feel the ghosts. You can feel the ghosts of what you're writing about. So yeah, there's nothing better than to have that experience.
So there's going to be a movie version of The Corporation. Can you talk about, I read that there was kind of like this bidding war broke out between different studios that wanted to get their hands on it. So can you talk a little bit about that and like who's making the movie, and do you play any role in that now that it's going to go on the screen?
Right. Well, that all happened very early in the process based on the book proposal. I wrote a very detailed book proposal for this book, like 125 page chapter by chapter breakdown. I tend to do that. It takes time. It's time consuming and a lot of work, but it usually bears fruit because it gives a very detailed, it's sort of a very detailed, condensed version of the book. And in the long run, it helps me get a better deal with a publisher because they can see the book. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it read like a treatment for a movie. And so the interest was immediate and intense. I mean, I've had other books optioned for movies, but nothing quite like this. Part of it was, you know, this is really an epic, this is kind of a classic epic mobster saga. You can legitimately compare it to the Godfather movies. Mm-hmm. It has that kind of scope. And so the interest was there from some big players. And there was an intense bidding war over a period of a few days. And when all the dust settled, it was Paramount Studios, along with Leonardo DiCaprio's company, Appian Way, who optioned the rights to the book with Benicio del Toro attached to play the lead role of Jose Miguel Battle. And so that was exciting. But, you know, for me as the author of the book, it was also quite annoying. I mean, there's enough pressure just writing a book, getting it together, getting it done, getting it down on the page. A lot of work and a lot of pressure. The last thing I needed was Hollywood people checking in with me. And they hired a screenwriter to begin writing the screenplay, you know, while I was writing the book. This happened to me once before with the Westies, and it's not the way I would choose to have it take place if it was up to me. It just adds a lot of pressure to the process of writing a book. So it was a little bit annoying. And but it's ongoing. They're developing it. They have a first draft of a script that needs work, and they'll continue that process. But all the main players are still very much involved. Mm-hmm. DiCaprio's company, Benicio del Toro. It's a great role for him. He's perfect for the part, and it's It's his Don Corleone. So hopefully it will be done right. I think one of the problems they have is it's going to be hard to do it in a 2 or even a 3 hour movie, and then a miniseries would make more sense to me, because there's a lot of story, a lot of incredible subplots involving some outrageous killings and other acts of mayhem. And if they're going to want to utilize all the things that story has to offer, I think that they may wind up wanting to go the miniseries route eventually.
Mm-hmm. So what happened with the Westies? Did it just never made it past like a...
that's a long, not terribly interesting story, to be honest. I mean, that the Westies was the proverbial hot property way back when the book was published. The movie State of Grace came out, which was sort of a ripoff of the Westies story. And some people liked that movie. Regardless of how you feel about the movie, it was a financial disaster. It was a flop.
Yeah.
And so it kind of put a bad stink on the idea of an Irish-American, New York-based gangster movie for a while. But then it got hot again, and people got involved, and screenplays were written, and they just never could quite get it right in the writing of it. It came close a few times along the way to being made, and then it would not happen. And, of course, every time it comes close like that and then doesn't happen, it takes on baggage and becomes more complicated. And it's just gone on and on. I mean, it's still in development as some sort of property, either a movie or a miniseries or something, and it may still happen, but I've stopped being a part of it and stopped even sort of taking much interest in whether or not it happens. I'm more absorbed in more recent books being developed, along with the corporation. Havana Nocturne is being developed as a miniseries for television with a great writer attached, Terrence Winter, the creator of Boardwalk Empire, and a writer from The Sopranos, will be the head writer on that. And I have a feeling you'll be hearing announcements about that within the next few months. And so that'll be a big deal once it kicks in.
Do you take a break, or do you immediately start in on your next project, or just kind of like, how does that work for you?
Yeah, in this line of work, you don't get to take breaks.
Mm-hmm.
You really should be on to the next project, you know, even before this book is published. So I usually move right from one project into another. Mm-hmm. And I am working on another Cuban-related crime story that I don't really want to talk about because it's really at an early stage and I'm still sort of in negotiation with some key players in that story, so I'd rather not get into it. But yeah, if you're lucky, an idea will grow out of something you're doing. That's what happened in this case. I mean, I found that in the Cuban-American crime realm, there are still a lot of really great stories that haven't been told yet from the 80s and the 90s. A lot of what I do is write non-Italian mafia stories. I mean, for the longest time, ever since, I guess, the Godfather movies came on the scene, the mafia, the Italian mafia, has so dominated popular culture's conception of what organized crime in the United States is that for the longest time, it was kind of the only game in town. And in the 90s, when I started really writing as a journalist about this subject matter, I was fascinated by more recent versions of the story. And so I wrote a series for Playboy magazine back in the 90s called The New Mob. And so I've been writing about Jamaican gangs and Mexican cartels and the Chinese and Asian underworld and all these great stories of more recent versions of the American process, the American dream. These stories have been neglected, and there's a lot of great crime stories in this realm of organized crime that haven't been told. And I have a feeling that now, finally, these kinds of stories are coming into their own, and people are recognizing that the Asian story, the Mexican American story, the Cuban story are part of the American story. And so there's a point of identification with these stories that maybe wasn't there before. And now these stories can be told at a high level. I mean, it's no accident that The Corporation became such a hot property as a movie. I think part of that is just that the Latino story is kind of hot in the United States now. Mm-hmm. And people have a real interest in it. And so this recent Cuban American history, particularly with its steeped in the politics of the revolution and also just, you know, the cocaine era of the 1980s, there's a lot to write about. So I may come back to this subject matter again and again.
You started a record label recently. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I kind of feel like I just booked a berth on the Titanic. you know, the record label at a time when recorded music is kind of going through a terrible process. I mean, the music industry is dying out. What it comes from really is just my love of jazz and Latin jazz in particular. And I've been hosting a series in New York City called Dangerous Rhythms at a jazz club in New York, where I'm curating and hosting the music, and mostly Latin jazz music. And so that led to me wanting to record some of it, particularly starting with this Cuban guitarist who recently moved from Cuba here, who's kind of a legendary musician in Cuba named Jorge Chicoy. So recorded his first CD, and that led to the creation of a label called Dangerous Rhythms. And I'll play with it for a while. I don't think there's any profit to be made from it, but if I can serve as sort of an impresario and promoter of the music that I love, well, then there's a lot of benefit in that for me, personal joy, and also the joy of helping to bring this great music to an audience, both in live shows and in recorded form. So, we have a CD coming out. It's called Havana Subway by the Jorge Chicoy Quintet, and that's coming out in early April, and you can buy the CD online at Amazon, and you can stream it on iTunes and all of that, and if you have an interest in this kind of music, you're really going to love it.
Cool. As somebody who's lived in New York for a long time, what's it like living there now as opposed to, you know, when you first got there? And is it still, I don't know, does it feel kind of, how has it changed, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, that's a big subject.
And do you still like it? I mean, do you still enjoy it as much as you used to?
Yeah, that's a big one. That's an ongoing conversation that all of us who've been here in New York for a long time, either born here or been living here for a long time, have been having, you know, how much the city's changed and whether it's necessary to live here anymore. You know, I wasn't born here. I came from the West Coast as a young guy, 21 years old, and came here in 1981. With a strong sense of a desire to become a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And so part of becoming a New Yorker was having to learn how to deal with this living environment, which at the time was very dangerous and perilous, a lot of crime. And to be a New Yorker, you really had to be on your toes. You had to have street smarts and survival skills that were very heightened. And I drove a cab here in the 80s during years that were really violent, the crack cocaine years. And so I took pride in developing those skills. And that, to me, was what defined becoming a New Yorker, having a hyper-awareness when you were out on the streets and just being able to get by without living in fear in New York. You know, a lot of people left during those years. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't want to live in fear in the way that you would have to. So those of us who stayed took a lot of pride in being, you know, street aware and street smart. That was a big part of being a New Yorker. Now you don't have to have that at all. Any old soft motherfucker can live in New York now, really. I mean, you know, people walk around with their head in their phone, total no awareness of what's going on around them. I mean, you used to be worried of muggings and purse snatchings and all kinds of things that could happen to you if you weren't paying attention. Now, nobody's paying attention. And so the feel of the streets is quite different. Most people would say it's a good thing. It's a safer place. And I have to agree with that. It's a safer place for women to walk around. You can take the subways now at almost any hour of the day and night and not be in fear like you were back in the 70s and 80s. But it's lost a certain edge and a certain grit to it. Mm-hmm. So it's not the living environment it once was. But on the other hand, it's still, for the arts and for things going on and the publishing business and the music business and clubs where you can go hear great music, the kind of music I love. I mean, I live in the Village. I've lived in the same apartment for 27 years in the West Village, and there's probably a half dozen really good jazz clubs within walking distance of my apartment. So that part of New York still exists. It's still, there's still a lot of great, you know, theater and music and the arts. So it's still the center of the, it still feels like the center of the universe in that regard. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if that sort of thing becomes less and less of interest to you and you're partaking of it less and less, then you might wind up asking yourself why you would still be living here, because it's a tough place to live. Apartments are small. It's still overcrowded. It gets more crowded, more densely populated than ever before. So it's got its pros and it's got its cons, but it's still New York. Mm-hmm. It's still the big show. It's still the place you have to be if you want to be a writer or you want to be an actor or you want to be a musician. I think you have to come through New York at least, or come to terms with New York mm-hmm. on some level. So it still fulfills that role. But it's no longer the testing ground. The streets of New York are no longer the testing ground that they once were.